Ukraine calling.
There will be peace, there will be just peace, and Ukraine will win.
650,000 fighting age men outside the country. There's nothing we can do about that, right?
In my view, I think it's more about incentivizing people than forcing them to do that. Procrastination on the part of our partners is giving Russia the most valuable asset, time, and Russia is weaponizing time. If we excel, which we do, in the drone sphere, of course we will be willing to share our experience, but at the same time, it's an opportunity for all our partners to improve the weapons that will help us protect ourselves in the future. This year, we will produce 1 million drones. All of our partners understand that that will not be the world in which we will feel safe. They understand the real risks, and they are just next door. The revolution of dignity, during which 100 people were killed, that was about our position on corruption as a civil society.
Hello, this is Brian Bonner again from Ukraine Calling, Hromadsky Radio's English language podcast. I am so happy today to have Yuri Sack in our midst. Yuri is one of the most influential and visible representatives of Ukraine during the entire war. Full-scale war. He has given more than 1,000 interviews, so he's a very familiar face. He's changed his role a little bit. Now he's an advisor to the Ministry of Strategic Industries, Alexander Kamyshyn, and he's been there since January or December. But before that, since the onset of the full-scale invasion, he was an advisor to Defense Minister Alexei Reznikov. And for a long time, he has worked in the consulting field in Ukraine for many, many years for CFC Big Ideas. They specialize in crisis communications, and that's needed now more than ever. He's had many clients over the years. I've known him where we've interacted since 2015, our email trail goes back, where he's represented very many different corporate clients and government as well. Yuri, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Brian. It's a pleasure and honor to be here.
Now, let's dive into maybe the news, because we're recording this day after President Zelensky signed into mobilization law that lowers the draft age from 27 to 25. Good idea?
Well, I think considering that we are now in our third year of this war, considering the fact that there's a big need to carry out rotation of the armed forces who are serving on the front lines, I think it's a timely idea, and it's an efficient way to improve the mobilization process and make sure that it's fair and transparent. That's my view.
Why 25? I mean, many nations like Israel start at 18. Do you agree with that?
In Ukraine, military age begins actually at 18, so that's when, in peacetime, men of this age, as soon as they reach it, they have to do military service. But again, you can rephrase that question as why it was 27 in the first place, right?
Right.
Today's generation, who are 25, 27, the sort of experiences that they have are sufficient for them to be in the army. And I will just repeat that it's the third year of the war, and we want to make sure that our army is capable of not just defending our territory and our sovereignty, but also carrying out in the future more offensive operations. So for this, we need our armed forces to be rotated on a regular basis.
So unfortunately, it looks like we may be in a permanent state of war.
Nobody will ever right now be able to tell you when this war will end, but one thing we can probably say with certainty is there will be peace, there will be just peace, and Ukraine will win.
I'm glad to hear that. I don't know what your estimate is, but 500,000 was the number of additional troops that has been floated around, and General Sirsky says no, it's fewer than that. So I'm not sure. Do you have a sense of how many more soldiers we need to conscript? To draft.
Well, exactly. General Sirsky, after he was appointed, they've carried out an audit of the armed forces of Ukraine as they are now, and they've realized that the number that you've said was floated, like 500,000, that's excessive. There's no need for so many of our soldiers. But I don't think the general staff has named an exact figure. But if they say it's considerably smaller, we can assume that it's, you know, many times less than 500,000.
That's awesome.
But we also have to understand our enemy, they are carrying out mobilization as well. So, and you've heard our president say recently, you know, we should be prepared for more offensive operations from the side of the aggressor come May and June. So this is another reason why we have to take the mobilization process seriously, and this is exactly the reason why that law is being enacted right now.
Exactly. Russia has lowered the draft age to 18, and there is a difference. Russia takes from 18 to 30, and we take from now 25 to 60. And the last figures I heard were Russia hopes to get at least 150,000 and maybe more troops to the front. Is that
what we heard as well, yes.
We'll see if they get them. We also have, a side note before we get into our the major topics, is 650,000 fighting age men outside the country. There's nothing we can do about that, right? They're out.
Well, there have been a number of different ideas, some of them involving limitations on the right of these people to use banking services. Some have involved calls for, making it more difficult for them to, for example, get new foreign passports, which they use as a sort of main document while they're abroad. But it's a difficult issue because once people leave, they leave for a reason, right? Getting them back is a challenge. But we have to also understand that even today, there are still Ukrainian men who are coming back from abroad and entering the armed forces of Ukraine as volunteers. So for probably understandable reasons, the news of these hordes of Ukrainian men in Europe who are trying to avoid draft, they spread fast. There's the other statistics, right, which shows Ukrainian men coming back and joining the armed forces of Ukraine. So there's a balance.
It's not a one-way street.
It's not a one-way street, no.
Okay. Best way to get them back is persuasion, patriotism, and there are coercive methods, but I gather that the government doesn't want to go that route.
Regardless of the government's desires, coercive methods, their implementation is not easy. You've heard statements from some of the European countries, for example, that now and again their politicians say, well, let's send some Ukrainian men back. And then the government of those countries comes out with a statement that it's against human rights. There are certain objective sort of circumstances which make it impossible. In my view, I think it's more about incentivizing people than forcing them to do that.
The other big thing, we're in early April and we still haven't got the $60 billion in U.S. aid. How soon before the situation becomes dire, in your estimation? Russia's already exploiting some of our weaknesses now.
Well, we're seeing that on the one hand, indeed, a long overdue decision by the Congress of the United States of America with regard to the $60 billion support aid package. Now, at the same time, our European partners have come together and, have unanimously adopted financial support for Ukraine in excess of $50 billion, which will, of course, spread over the years. But that in itself is already a backup plan. We've also seen in the last months the government of Japan come out with a proposal and they came forward with a $12 billion financial support package. And as we speak, somewhere in Brussels, the foreign ministers of the NATO countries are meeting, and we've seen reports that, Jens Stoltenberg, who is the current General Secretary of NATO, he came out with this idea that, to protect Ukraine from the volatility of the political winds of change, the NATO alliance will now consider a $100 billion support package just in case, things don't go as planned in the U.S. in terms of the $60 billion support package. But at the same time, we meet representatives of the Congress here in Kyiv almost on a daily basis, both Democrats and Republicans. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it is almost like difficult to grasp because you meet them, whether Republican or Democrat, and they all tell you how much they support Ukraine. And, they all assure you that this is like electioneering, but when the push will come to the shove, it will happen. So fingers crossed, it will happen. The disparity between the views that you hear from people you actually meet and the news that you get from the Capitol Hill, it's a bit unusual, to be honest.
Well, yeah, Financial Times said NATO wants to Trump-proof the aid to Ukraine, and that's going to be an interesting development and a welcome development, I think. I think everybody wants to know, and the New York Times had the story, too, that Ukraine is going to have to become self-sufficient, making its own weapons. And will we do this fast enough? Because if we don't in Ukraine, Ukraine is at the mercy of its Western partners or what it can afford to buy abroad. I think that's a big part of your mission now at the Ministry of Strategic Industries.
Well, first of all, I don't think any country in the world needs to be, or actually can be, 100% self-sufficient, because, for instance, everything that the United States of America makes is based on the microchips and semiconductors they get from Taiwan, for example, all right? And that means that in Ukraine, of course, we don't need to even aspire to build our own Patriot systems or NASAMS or Iris-T aerial air defense systems, or, you know, there are certain types of weapons objectively is not possible to quickly develop and start producing in Ukraine. At the same time, this war has taught us all the art of war is changing. The modern warfare is like, if you speak to even military experts and you ask them, would they have envisaged this few months before the large-scale invasion, they would have all said in one voice that, you know, if there is a big war, it will be aerial war, it will be a war of, you know, a couple of days, like the Desert Storm operation, for instance, right? And then what followed shocked and surprised so many of us and so many of the even military experts abroad, because it's a hybrid warfare where, on the one hand, you have the sort of trench warfare similar to what was happening in the World War One, but at the same time, you have a modern warfare with drone technologies, you know, first-person view drones, bomber drones, naval drones, aerial drones. Our strategy is indeed to be self-sufficient and where we can compensate for the stuff that we don't have yet. For example, while we are waiting for the F-16s, okay, and while we sometimes experience the shortage of ammunition for the artillery, we are relying more and more on drones, right? And they have, on many occasions, they have been a very decent substitute to air superiority. So there's even a term now, low altitude air superiority, and we have been able to actually achieve that in most parts of the front line. Of course, Russians are learning fast, and this is why we always say that procrastination on the part of our partners is giving Russia the most valuable asset, time. And Russia is weaponizing time, and the way they do it, they learn, right? So they do reverse engineering, they come up with their own electronic warfare systems, and they make it more difficult for us to maintain the low altitude drone air superiority. But we're kind of doing okay on that front. Now, on the other hand, we don't have the high altitude or fixed wing air superiority. It is not likely that we will have it anytime soon, because even after we get the F-16s that we were promised, there will still be insufficient, of course, to oppose the Russians, who have vast numbers of fighter jets, bombers, and so on and so forth. But we have proven time and again, and this is actually something that Mr. Sirski, General Sirski, said when he was appointed, that in this war, which has been regarded for a long time as the story of David versus Goliath, right? We're the David, so we have to be smart. So we don't sort of use quantity, but we are smart about how we use the stuff that we have. And this has allowed us to, first of all, withstand the aggression during the first days of the war, to liberate Kyiv, Chernihiv, and those parts in the first months, then Kharkiv, then Kherson. And at the moment, you know, look, we're still standing in a war that many Western experts predicted would not have lasted longer than 3 days. Going back to the original question, you know, we, of course, want to be self-sufficient. At the same time, we realize that there are certain weapons systems that will have to be continued to be supplied to Ukraine by our partners. But we want to be equal partners. This is why, for instance, if we excel, which we do, in the drone sphere, in the drone industry, you know, when the war ends with our victory, we will be willing to share our, we already do, in fact, share our experience. This is invaluable experience. You know, unfortunately, we are a testing ground for different types of weapons, including the ones that we get from our partners.
Is it fair to say the various types of drones are where we are? Ukraine is leading right now in terms of...
In many respects, cutting. Exactly, yes. Moreover, sometimes, you know, we hear stories, sometimes we get some equipment from our partners. When we get it, it is touted as like good and high quality, but then there are certain real combat conditions that, when discovered, rendered these weapons not so efficient, so they had to be adjusted. And this is why we tell our partners, you know, yes, it's a tragic war, but at the same time, it's an opportunity for all our partners to improve the weapons that will help us protect ourselves in the future. So why not use this opportunity?
There's many things that have stunned the world. And one is, you don't need a navy to destroy the other.
Exactly.
The enemy's navy.
Exactly. The way we have been able to use the Ukrainian-made naval drones to destroy Russian warships, Russian landing ships, and to actually deny Russia the right of freedom of shipment in the Black Sea. The Black Sea fleet now is, on a daily basis, is under the risk of being attacked. So they are not able to just float around the Black Sea with impunity and terrorize Ukraine and other countries. That's a good development.
Even though Ukraine is spending a lot more on research and development and weapons production, I believe it was Kamishin who said that, and everybody else, that we don't have enough investment, we don't have enough money to produce what we want. After drones, what would be on the wish list of the things that are most strategically necessary to win this war that you would like to see more domestically produced?
Well, ammunition is one such thing, and 155 caliber, as our minister Alexander Kamishin has said most recently in one of his interviews. So that's on the way. That's something that we understand, because look, our long-term objective, of course, is to become a member of NATO. That means that our army needs to be interoperable with other NATO member countries, and that means that we aspire to gradually replace all the old Soviet-style weapon systems with the new NATO-standard weapon systems. Now, this means that the more we are able to produce here in Ukraine, produce as well as provide maintenance, I mean, the more we will be prepared to join NATO when the time comes. So it's top priority for the Ministry of Strategic Industries, for the government in general, and we are on our way.
And NATO and Europe still have a long way to go to unify their standards, as I understand it.
Well, in many respects, that has been an interesting point, because in many respects, Ukraine has achieved already good results in standardizing more than some of the existing NATO countries. But we understand that our membership at the NATO alliance depends on the outcome of this war, because there are certain legally prescribed conditions that have to be satisfied by an aspiring member before they're allowed to join.
How do you keep track of all of it? Because I read stories that the UK is producing components for this type of drone, and different European weapons makers are talking about or already here. And obviously, you're going to have to keep those locations secret because they become targets. But is it fair to say we're at the beginning of this quest for self-sufficiency, or we're already well underway?
I would answer that question by, again, quoting Alexander Kamishin, who said that, you know, when, you know, he was before the CEO of Ukrzaliznitsa, so some of his analogies are based on his previous experiences.
Exactly.
So he says, when you have a standing train, it's enough to just put one small brick under the wheels of that train, and it will not be possible to move it an inch. But once the train gets going, then you can build a brick wall in front of the train and it just goes through it. So our train, our defense industry-based train, is already moving and moving fast. And, you know, when we say that next year, this year, we will produce 1 million drones, it's based on fact. It's based on real capabilities, on real innovation discoveries. And we're thinking the strategy for this year and next year is to be actually a few steps ahead of our enemy. Because like I said, they are also developing, they're also quadrupling their defense industry spendings. And we are aware of that.
Well, they're on a war footing, that's for sure. $140
yeah.
billion at least. It just seems like they've turned into a war economy. And I don't think it's just for Ukraine. It's the reordering of their society, it looks like, to be an aggressive military threat for a long time. I look at everything. So you have the Ministry of Defense. You have strategic industries. You have digital transformation. Then you have a special drone unit. And then you have Ukroboron Prom, which is a state, you know, mega defense concern. I say, oh, my God, this is bureaucracy. run amok. Am I wrong, or is there a clear division of responsibilities?
Let's go back to February 2022, and when the large-scale invasion began, if an outsider would look at how things were organized, they would probably go crazy because everything looked chaotic. You know, like everything, everybody was doing everything, right? From bulletproof vests to providing pickup trucks to the army, but that was the requirement of that time. Right, so you needed everybody to be involved in order to survive. And little by little, that chaos was substituted by predictable systems. And, you know, some of those processes have been handed over to, for example, the Ministry of Defense. And right now, it's all sort of going towards standardization and predictability, and which will result in good management, right, in efficiency. Mm-hmm. So with the drone sphere, it's the same. The moment we realized that drones are a very powerful force on the battlefield, you know, the whole country started making drones, advocating for drones, inventing new types of drones. And little by little, all of this is beginning to be shaped into a predictable and efficient system. President Zelensky, a few months ago, instituted the unmanned systems force within the armed forces of Ukraine. Vadim Sukharevsky is the commander of this force. And the strategy is for this unmanned vehicles force to be the focal point for the whole, if you like, drone industry. That will be agency that will have the information, first of all, from the front lines, the needs of the army. It will have information about the innovations. And of course, all the others, the Ministry of Strategic Industries, the Ministry of Digital Transformation, all of those who are currently heavily involved in drone production, manufacturing, and distribution, they will all be part of the same system. But the system is now moving towards a more, say, organized structure, because this is needed for efficiency, for speed in this very dynamic warfare.
So you're hopeful about everybody doing their job and not duplicating or...
Well, absolutely. Look, on a daily basis, representatives of these different organizations are meeting, and, you know, if there is an area where there's some duplication, it's removed. Because everybody's driven by the same goal, to win the war. And to win the war, you need to be efficient.
Let's run quick history of our defense capabilities, which is not a happy story. In the 90s, we disarmed, got rid of our nuclear weapons and missiles under international pressure and to try to be a good neighbor in terms of promoting non-nuclear proliferation. We got the Budapest Memorandum in return, which didn't turn out to offer us much in the way of assurances, and one of the signatories is attacking us, Russia. Then from 2010 to 2014, Yanukovych pretty much decimated what was left of the defense industry, it seems. At least three of his former defense ministers are now in exile in Russia on treason charges. And we didn't have much. And then Ukraine was attacked. When you came to the ministry, what was this in 2022? What was the state of it at the time? Had a lot of progress been made from 2014 to 2022?
This is something that I've learned probably about 6 months after the beginning of the large-scale invasion, because this was information that wasn't shared very widely at the beginning. But when the large-scale invasion began, we as a country had stuff in terms of weapons, ammunition, and everything to last us, you know, a month and a half at max. Everybody realized that, and this is the state that we were in terms of the resources of the army, right? Now, at the same time, the army that met the aggressor in 2022, in February 2022, the Ukrainian, was a different army than the one in 2014, because we always repeat and stress that this war began not on February 24th, 2022, right? It began in 2014 after the annexation of Crimea and after the proxy wars in Donbass and illegal annexation of parts of those territories. On the one hand, we had a very capable army made up of very capable commanders and soldiers who had a very, very unique combat experience from 2014. And on the other hand, we had a weak sort of resource base of that army. This is why the first months of the war were dedicated to procuring weapons from wherever it was possible to procure them, you know, and Soviet-style weapons, because nobody was actually back then confident that Ukraine will ever win. This is why, you know, nobody, like, if you remember, the first NATO standard artillery pieces like M777s, for example, we got only in like May. And that was the first time when seeing how Ukrainian army has liberated Kyiv and Chernihiv, our partners abroad started to believe that, okay, Ukraine can fight this war and we need to help them. But at the beginning, of course, it was very dire. A very simple illustration is something which you might have actually seen by now. At the beginning, we had just one Bogdana, which is a NATO standard 155 millimeter caliber howitzer, self-propelled howitzer. We had just one. Now we are producing 8 a month. That's a very good illustration as to where we were and where we are at the moment. And
they're effective, right? From what are they most effective at?
Well, they are very effective because they can strike enemy at long distances. And they were used for the liberation of the Snake Island. And apparently aggressor soldiers were surprised that it was even possible to use artillery at such distances. So it's something that we are proud of and is being made.
So when you came in, we had a good army, but not enough weapons, not enough tools.
Well, exactly, because in February we had what? We only had a couple of dispatches of Stingers and Javelins that were delivered to Ukraine from the US. We received some NLAWs from the UK, which of course was a lifesaver, because had we not had those types of anti-tank and aircraft weapons, the situation could have been even more difficult.
Looking back, I don't know if you've had any time to reflect, but were there times where we had peaks and valleys? During the peaks that you thought, listen, we're going to win this and we're going to win this soon, and it's not just PR or propaganda, and other times where you said, oh, I don't know how long we're going to be able to hold on?
Well, first of all, I've never had, honestly, hand on heart, I never had this thought that, you know, how long are we going to be able to hold on? Because I'm confident that we will win. It's just a matter of time and price that we will have to pay for this victory. Because it's inevitable. You know, you cannot make the river flow backwards. The same way you cannot, we don't just have examples from history where empires would disintegrate and then would be resurrected. That just didn't happen before, and I don't think it will happen with the Kremlin's desire to resuscitate the Soviet Empire. So on that count, I'm pretty confident that we'll win. I've never had those thoughts. Now, I was extra excited and overconfident after we have liberated Kherson. Of course, that was the moment in time when Kharkiv and then Kherson, it felt like the momentum was on our side. It felt like the enemy was demoralized and degraded to such an extent that the front will collapse. And this was actually confirmed by the stuff that we have in our reports from the other side. You know, there was panic in their ranks. It was a period of high hopes, and it was very easy to sort of speak on behalf of Ukraine to international media during that period because hopes were running high. Now, another period of high hopes was the sort of beginning of the so-called summer counteroffensive last year. But little by little, the more we learned about how deeply entrenched the enemy was in Zaporizhia Oblast, in Kherson Oblast, the more we learned about the strength of their fortification lines, the more we understood that there were serious delays with the provision to us of the weapons that we requested and were promised by our partners, the more it became obvious that the progress that we planned was unattainable. And while it wasn't reason to feel defeatist or to stop believing in Ukraine's victory, but it was a period when it was a bit of a pessimistic period, if you like.
Yeah, we just, after Kharkiv and Kherson, we just didn't have the weapons to go further.
Yes.
Yes, the delays, which brings us to the West strategy. And I know you have to do a diplomatic dance, but I've had guests, Kurt Volker and Ben Hodges, say basically, and they're both Americans, so they speak bluntly about America. They say there's no strategy to win, and we need a strategy to win. The West has to say we're going to win this war and get together with Ukraine and say, what do we need to win this war? Are they right?
Of course, if you listen to the official statements of the leaders of our partner countries, they repeatedly say unanimously that Putin must not be allowed to win. Ukraine is fighting for our shared values, and that Ukraine's victory is in our own national interest. And I, you know, in my view, they say it sincerely because they understand that we are going through a period of tectonic changes on the geopolitical arena. There is a group of states who are interested in a major reshuffle, in changing the rules-based order into something else, which nobody understands what it will be, but I think all of our partners understand that that will not be the world in which we will feel safe, in which we will have stability, and in which we will be able to, you know, preoccupy with ourselves with things like climate change and whatever. We'll be just in the survival mode permanently, because right now, you can see right now there's Ukraine on fire. There's the situation in Gaza. There are daily alerts coming from Taiwan. It's a moment in history when the leaders of the civilized nations understand it's now or never. I'll have to be careful with the choice of words. If they allow Ukraine not to defeat Russia, I don't think anybody is even considering that as an option. And we're seeing, for example, the European countries during recent months, when they saw that the situation on the front lines is not as positive and rosy as they were hoping for, they understand the real risks and they are just next door. Despite, for example, the position of the Hungarian prime minister, right? When it came to the voting for the financial support bill, they all came together and voted unanimously in favor of it. We're seeing the change of stance in France. Right, very, very powerful recent weeks. The United Kingdom has been a staunch supporter. Germany, Italy. I'm confident that everybody understands the risks and everybody wants to help. It's just there are sometimes bureaucratic processes in countries which are living peace that are slower than they need to be during time of war.
Corruption during time of war is stealing from soldiers. It's stealing from taxpayers. The defense ministry was tainted with some allegations. How widespread was corruption? Was it exaggerated? Do you even know the extent? And since corruption is basically everywhere in every nation, the way to combat it is to have processes to prevent it and to punish it. What would you say about that subject?
First of all, I would say that Ukrainians as a nation have the vast majority of us. We have zero tolerance to corruption, and we can all ask Yanukovych about how that works out. For people who have doubts in our attitude towards corruption. Because the revolution of dignity, during which 100 people were killed, and in essence, that revolution, that peaceful protest, which ended up in bloodshed, in the killing of peaceful protesters, that was about our position on corruption as a civil society. At the same time, things like rooting out corruption, it doesn't happen overnight. And you rightly said that corruption exists in every country in the world. It's about the existence of efficient mechanisms that allow the society to detect and deal with the incidents of corruption in a way which is just, fair, and is perceived as just and fair by the society. I'm confident that we are moving towards a society in which the institutions are in place, also with the help of our partners, and you have seen, even in recent, since the scandals in the Ministry of Defense, you know, those people who were implicated, they are now either under investigation or have been detained and are kept in prison. There have been, for example, the head of the Supreme Court who was caught red-handed taking a 2 million bribe. He has been detained and is now under prosecution. There have been many other instances involving, for example, military heads of the conscription units, right? The corruption in that field. We are aware of corruption in Ukraine. We are fighting it as much as we can. Again, it's like with the war. Our victory over corruption is just as inevitable as our victory over Russia. It's just a matter of time. And one thing I would like to say in this context is this. Of course, Russian propaganda cherry picks these incidents and amplifies it using billions of dollars, of petrodollars, internationally to discredit Ukraine, to discredit the whole of Ukraine, the whole of Ukrainian government, to convince Ukraine's partners that, you know, Ukraine is a corrupt country, don't give it aid, don't give it weapons. And I was personally involved in, for example, false reports by even organizations such as Amnesty International, who would come out with a report claiming that Ukraine did something wrong, that Ukraine is corrupt, and that would be picked up by foreign media and then spread in the parliaments in Brussels, in Washington, D.C. And, you know, those who are against support of Ukraine would use that as an argument. So we have to be aware that Russian propaganda is still at work. Its information war against Ukraine is just as active, if not more, as the actual kinetic war on the front lines. So when we hear news about corruption in Ukraine, we have to, you know, those of us who are responsible with our information, let's double check. We are fighting corruption. It's not an easy challenge, but it's happening and it's being public, transparent, and we will defeat it.
Well put, and I think there'll be no shortage of the need for crisis communications for a while, which is your specialty. Thank God for Ukraine, mm-hmm. and thank God for that. Yuri, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Brian. Always a pleasure.
That's it for our program. It was a great program. I really enjoyed this interview, and I hope you did too. Please tune in on YouTube, on Hromadsky Radio's website, and on all the major platforms where podcasts can be found. We reach an audience of potentially billions of people around the world, so hopefully many of you will tune in. And please join us again next week for another exciting program of Ukraine Call.
This is Ukraine Calling.